Welcome to Inspiring Stories for Bauer and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Hello, my name is Tim McMillan. Welcome to another episode of Inspiring Stories brought to you by Bauer and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. My guest in this episode has applied sports science at the very top end of the athlete world. He has worked in football on two particular codes, being AFL and also the round ball, at some of the biggest clubs in Australia and around the world, the likes of Melbourne, Port Adelaide, the Socceroos, Arsenal and Liverpool, to name just a few of them. So it's with great pleasure I say hello and welcome to Darren Burgess. How are you, Darren?
Good, thanks, Tim. Nice to be on the show. I appreciate the invitation.
We appreciate you you sparing the time for us. Darren, you spend so much of your time looking after everyone else's welfare. How's your own?
Yeah, thanks for the question. Yeah, not too bad. It was a tough year last year for many different reasons, but in particular, you know, going up and spending 3 months away from sort of home and family in the hub in Queensland, which was fantastically put on by the AFL, but it was pretty brutal. But we're back now in some sort of sense of normality here in Australia compared to the rest of the world. So coping okay, I think.
Yeah, that's good to hear. Look, I don't want to test your humility here, Darren, straight away, but Melbourne, where you're currently at, flying in season 2021, how much credit can you take for that?
I've had a lot of people say, what's the difference this year compared to last year? Look, the players deserve, for me, the players and the coaches deserve all the credit. They're the ones doing the hard work. We just sort of provide, myself and my team provide a platform with which they can do their work. And I'm really, really happy to see them getting a reward for their effort. Of course, we're 9 rounds in and there's still a whole lot to play. So we're not getting carried away, but it's a good start, really good start.
Well, without divulging too many of your secrets, Darren, are you doing anything differently? Have you sort of completely revamped the program there?
No, not necessarily. What the players have done is developed a really good tolerance to work. And I think sometimes we in the sports science world can protect them too much by not letting them train and not letting them work. Whereas our philosophy has been to try and protect them from future injury by building up some resilience in their workload and trying to be as specific to footy as possible. So not just running laps or anything like that, but trying to build up some really specific resilience both on the field and in the gym and wherever else we can. And hopefully that's paying dividends. Look, you know, we can only do what we think is right, and so far so good.
There's been a lot of talk this year about the huge number of injuries across the entire league. You mentioned, you know, the idea of not just putting people on the sidelines and have them sort of sit out and nurse their injuries. How are you managing that, the huge toll that is obviously taking on the players' bodies and their fitness levels, but also, you know, keeping them running at full tilt through four quarters every week?
Yeah, to be honest, Tim, it's been a pretty brutal first 2.5 months, and if you include pre-season, 3 months. The injury rates across the league, the likes of which I haven't seen before. So it has been tough, and it has been a real balancing act for the whole sort of coaching and fitness and medical team. And how we're doing it, we're still going with the philosophy of, when we can, putting heavy load into the players. And obviously when it's not appropriate to do so, recovering them well. It's been a real balancing act to try and prepare the guys for battle each week, because nobody knew the rotations were less, the time was extended. Nobody knew what the game was going to look like. And really, after 9 rounds, we're starting to get a view that the intensity is still good and high. But the players are being asked to perform that intensity for longer than they did last year, and the year before, in fact. So, it's a demanding process for all of us. And hopefully we're getting to a level now where it'll start to even out across the league, because everybody wants to see the best players play.
Yeah, absolutely. Last year was a pretty chaotic and unpredictable time for everyone, not just in AFL, not just in the world of sport. What did you learn as far as your role goes, as someone who's got to get the best out of these guys? What did you learn from a sports science perspective from last year?
Yeah, I guess I was a bit fortunate in coming from a soccer sort of background where we're used to getting players up and ready to play, you know, 3-4 days in between games, sometimes two over the Christmas period in the Premier League. So having that shorter period between games, we felt like we handled that pretty well because we could rely on experience of a few of the staff who'd worked overseas. So what did I learn? I learned that the players, if they buy in, can really achieve anything from a physical point of view, and they did buy in. I learned the importance of mental state on physical performance and injuries. That was really, really heightened by, you know, some players who struggled a bit in the hub, some coaches, some fitness people who struggled from time to time. It really did affect their performance and affected some injury rates. So we certainly pay more attention to that. Now, the players importantly learned that they can back up after 2 or 3 days, you know, traveling the day of the game, whatever the AFL threw at us and whatever our fixture threw at us, they learned that, you know, we can just tolerate that. And there's been a couple of occasions this year where that's come in handy. We had to travel the day of the game to Hobart, you know, on a 7:30 a.m. flight to play at 1 p.m. So, you know, those sort of challenges we were able to handle a lot better having gone through last year.
How much did you love the shorter quarters?
Yeah, it was great. Loved it. And our players loved it. Everybody loved it. I'm, you know, it's not my, you know, position to stay to say what the game should look like. That's for far smarter people than me. But I'd be certainly keen to bring it back a little bit anyway, because everything was more intense and dynamic. And yeah, for sure. I enjoyed it.
I'm keen to hear what your actual day looks like. So we know how professional AFL players have to be these days. But firstly, paint a picture for us on game day. I mean, I'm sure you're there, and to some extent you're watching as, you know, thousands of spectators would, but what you have to look at on the ground is quite different to just about anyone else in the arena on that day. Can you talk us through what a game day looks like from your point of view?
Yeah, it's not as glamorous as what some would think. So the players are expected to arrive somewhere around 2 hours before the game. I'm probably there 3 hours before, just making sure that everything is in order and just getting everything set up. So we've got great staff here who do some unbelievable work. But there's a lot that goes into the nutrition and getting the GPS ready and getting all the computers and the iPads ready for when the game starts. When the players arrive, I'm normally looking at some individuals who like a little bit of specificity in their sort of warm-up. I'm a big believer in letting the players prepare themselves. Obviously, I'm involved in coaches meetings, speaking to coaches about rotations and things like that. I take the team warm-up, which is sort of 15 minutes before the game starts. And then during the game, it's probably the more intense period, because I've generally got my head in an iPad looking at rotations. My sports scientist, David Regan, is behind sort of letting me know, because all the players are wearing GPS, letting me know when players are fatigued. And then it's good. He's great. He leaves all the rotations up to myself. So I'm in charge of when players come off, who comes on, what position they play. I've got the earphones in so I can hear what the coaches are talking about. And then try and make decisions on the run. The sports scientist might be saying that Cozzy Pickett is flagging for fatigue, and I'm trying to watch, saying, well, you know what, he's just kicked two. I'm probably not going to take him off because he's feeling really good. Let me know when it's urgent. He might say it's urgent, and the player might not want to come off. And so you're managing all those situations at once. So keeping an eye on the number on the cap now, keeping an eye on how many rotations the opposition have had to see if they try and get a jump on us. So I don't get to watch the game. I typically go home and watch it afterwards. That's the frustration of my partner. that's typically what a day looks like. And then afterwards there's recovery. The players who didn't play, if they're a medical sub and didn't play, or if someone we carried over, we go on the field afterwards, myself and Selwyn, Our head of S&C will go out and train them. And then I'll be back in with the coaches just talking about, okay, next week, this is what it looks like. Player A, B and C had a corky from the game, so he might not train early in the week. So it's a pretty full on day. Normally don't leave till sort of 2 hours after the game finishes.
Yeah, right. So a lot of intelligence gathering as well as critical decisions in the moment.
Absolutely. Yeah. This weekend, got into trouble, made a slightly wrong rotation and got yelled at by the coaches and some of the staff who were listening. Oh, that was pretty full on. Oh, I've been yelled at by better coaches than that and more often than that, you know. So, you've got to be on point and got to be ready to go.
There are some, you know, old school footy fanatics who think that there's too much science, there's too much data, there's too much worrying about the numbers and not enough of just getting on with the game that they grew up loving, which has changed obviously over the years. What do you say to people who think that is the case?
Yeah, I think there is. We went as an industry, we went down that path maybe 5 years ago, where there was probably a bit too much. But I think we've come back into a nice balance now. The really good practitioners around the league appreciate the need for, for players to be on the ground longer than what the data might suggest if they've got a good matchup and who can have a feel for the game and feel for training. And, you know, I remember it was 10 years ago, a lot of clubs were counting kicks, goal kicks. Players can only have 10 shots after a game because of fear of quad injuries. I've never done that in my life because kicking goals is pretty bloody important to winning a game. So I think there's a tendency to do that at times, but I think as an industry we've come back from that and we're in a pretty good balance now, particularly, you know, some of the really good experienced practitioners.
Yeah. Darren, we need to take a quick break. After that, I want to ask you about your experience in a different football code. And I have to come clean. I'm a massive Arsenal fan, so I'm intrigued by your time at the Gunners. So I'm going to pick your brain about that. Darren Burgess is our special guest, high performance manager currently at the Melbourne Footy Club. This is Inspiring Stories. Back with more in just a moment.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. Fitness guru Darren Burgess is our special guest in this episode. Let's wind the clock back pre-Melbourne Football Club for a moment, Darren. You spent a couple of years at my favourite Premier League club in Arsenal. So I need to know all about that. Give us the inside word from your time at the Gunners. Firstly, how did you come to hook up with Arsenal?
It was very much out of the blue. Got a phone call late one night after a game, in fact, when I was working for Port Adelaide, by a gentleman by the name of Ivan Gazidis, who was the CEO of Arsenal at the time. And it was completely out of the blue. I've no idea how he got my number or anything like that.
How does he even know who the high performance managers are in a foreign league in a foreign country? Did someone recommend you?
Yeah, as it turned out, they identified the need to bring somebody in to help their department because their injury rates were pretty ordinary, and you would know this being a fan. There was a lot of frustration around the high injury rates, so they identified the need to bring someone in, and then they went and did their own search, and they spoke to a couple of people who recommended myself, one of which was the owners of Liverpool, who I worked with previously, the Fenway Sports Group guys who I had a pretty good relationship with, I guess. Then they spoke to some people in France that I'd worked with and they fortunately mentioned my name and a couple of others. And then they went through a bit of a process where we were speaking, you know, every sort of 5 or 6 days for about 3 or 4 weeks. Then they thought the interviews went well enough to fly me over, and I met Arsene Wenger in Nice. I flew on a Friday morning and got back to Adelaide by Monday morning, and had about 12 hours with Arsene in a hotel in Nice. And by the time I flew back, to Adelaide, I'd had a contract emailed to me. So it was very much a whirlwind sort of 4 days, of which three of them were spent flying.
Did you and Arson just nerd out about sports science? I mean, knowing some of his background, he's a revolutionary, isn't he? He was credited with really bringing a new level of sports science to the Premier League when he arrived back in the mid-90s.
He's underappreciated for sure, because unfortunately Arsenal didn't get the success that that Man United got at the time, and so, but he was incredible attention to detail. He asked a lot of questions about football. I think he had some doubts. In fact, I know he had some doubts about me being a football person. So he asked me a lot about football. Unfortunately, you know, I'm a football lover, so I was able to answer a lot of historical information about players and events and games. And then when I got there, he still had some distrust because there was a lot that needed to be changed, and he was very loyal to some of those people who perhaps weren't doing as well as weren't up to the level that he was. And so, you know, we made some changes pretty early on, which I think caught him off guard a bit, people that he'd worked with quite closely. But then as I would hope, he would gain trust as he knew that I was in the club for the right reasons. And that happened over time. And we had some pretty honest conversations when he left, which was quite a sad day.
Yep.
But he was an absolute pleasure to work with.
Yep.
Incredible human and coach.
Translating your skills from an AFL setting to a different league in a different country, how much of it could you take with you to London? You just come off sort of 5-odd years at Port Adelaide. What could you take, for instance, from your time at Port Adelaide to a setup like Arsenal's?
Fortunately, I'd had the years at the Socceroos and Liverpool to prepare me for it. Arsenal was a very different role. I had, I can't remember the number of staff. I was, you know, in charge of the performance from the academy all the way up. Obviously, there was a main focus on the first team, but all the psychologists, the performance analysts, the doctors, the physios, the fitness, the nutrition, all the way from the under eight all the way up. So it was a different role. So not a lot from the sort of Port Adelaide, other than typical overload principles and specificity and how to get players fit, because Arsene wanted me to be sort of hands-on. But it was more about building relationships with staff, with Arsene, with his staff, and with the players. And I guess once they knew that I was there for them, they were quite happy. Certainly the coaching staff were really frustrated with the service they were getting prior to, and hopefully I was able to work with the current staff in providing the coaches exactly what they wanted. There was this sort of reverence and fear around Arsene that you can't talk to him about that, you can't talk to him about that. And so the CEO quite intuitively put my office literally next to Arsene's. And so we would have a lot of corridor and incidental conversations, which I think helped a lot.
Yeah. In terms of, you know, comparing the codes, comparing your time, I mean, you know, there are a lot of hardcore footy fans here in Australia, but the level of fanaticism in something like the English Premier League is just next level, isn't it? How did you go in what is just such a high-pressure situation? How did you cope with all of that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, Tim, because at that time, Arsenal weren't doing particularly well. We were navigating our way through the Europa League quite well, but Arsene was under immeasurable
pressure. Yeah.
And just global pressure. And yet he would turn up to work every day at 6 a.m. and you wouldn't know it. There was just one or two occasions where I thought, yeah, okay, he looks a bit stressed, but you honestly wouldn't know it. How did I handle it? The only way I sort of knew how, which was to treat Mesut Ozil as if I was treating Travis Boak or Ollie Wines, or, you know, they were just players to me. And I was trying to give them information to be the best players that they could be and surround them with the best service in order to provide Arsene with the best, you know, available players. So I didn't really read, well, I didn't read any of the, watch any of the TV shows or newspapers, or the only time it becomes apparent is when you do pre-season tours of Asia and you have 6,000 people turn up to training and 2,000 people at the hotel foyer. When Mesut Ozil walks out of his room, there's just,
People
unbelievable
everywhere.
cheering, and you arrive in a new destination at 2 a.m. in the morning, and there's thousands of people lining the airport streets, and that's when you realize, yeah, it's a slightly bigger, on a bigger scale. But they were the best times. I remember playing Napoli in a crucial Europa League game, and the fans were 4 and 5 deep and spitting on the bus and throwing eggs on the bus the whole way from the ground to the stadium. The same in Valencia for Europa League semi-final. And it was just brilliant. Literally security guards, Red Star Belgrade, walking down the race, the tunnel, which was about 45, 50 meters long. And in the tunnel, they just had the most intimidating paintings on the wall. And then you get to the ground, and there must have been 30 enormous army men, mainly men, with these huge machine guns as we're walking out to start our warm-up. And you're just thinking, okay, this is interesting.
We're in hostile territory here.
So only then did you really get the feeling that, okay, it's slightly bigger than just a football, mate, just a football game. But I think, you try not to let the pressure sort of get to you. And perhaps 20 years ago I might have, but I'm a bit older and grayer, and
Already
hopefully
had
good
some runs on the
luck.
board.
Yeah, hopefully.
And in terms of their their processes in place, their application to nutrition programs, training techniques, the science they apply, is it quite different to AFL?
It is. One of the things that people don't sort of probably appreciate, and Aussies who would reach out and say, can I get a job there? And do you know anybody? One of the really hard things is the different cultures coming from everywhere. We had 15 different nationalities, and I think it was 8 or 9 different languages spoken. And so, what nutrition strategies we would apply in Australia simply don't work over there. And people go, well, no, surely nutrition is nutrition. No, it's not, because my first tour with Liverpool was we had a pre-season camp in Switzerland, and it was just when the Spanish guys had come back from winning the World Cup. So it's Fernando Torres, Pepe Reina, big names. And I wrote up the meal times and everything just on a whiteboard. It was 7 p.m. dinner, 7:30 p.m. physio and massage treatment. And Pepe Reina got up out of his seat and rubbed that off and put 11 p.m. dinner. And
Spanish, yes, of
that's
course.
when, that's when Spanish eat. And so on. Okay, 7 p.m. I went back up. I thought maybe he's challenging me, the new guy, whatever. So I wrote back up 7 p.m. dinner, and then 11 p.m. dinner in brackets Spanish. And he laughed and smiled and said, "Yep, no worries." Those are the things that, I couldn't put Alex Iwobi in a ice bath. Why would you, when the 10 steps, from his dressing room to an ice bath are the 10 most nervous, stressful steps he'll take all week. So why would I put him in that ice bath, which universally in Australia, this is what we do for recovery, but it's causing him way more stress than it is recovering him. So little things like that, you had to learn, I guess, on the job, and you had to be observant and try and take into account their culture. So their strategies are very good, but they're also different.
I've got to ask. As a fan of the club, as I've mentioned, best players, fittest players, most difficult players at Arsenal that you worked with.
Look, the best player was Mesut Ozil. He was just an absolute. Honestly, the things he did at training were incredible. And he had his difficulties, and he was much maligned for his body language more than anything. So people assumed that he was lazy because of his body language. When he played, he was his numbers from running numbers were excellent. They weren't always great defensive running numbers, but that's not what he was in the team for. His role was to provide for the team. It was other people's job to defend for him, and that's, people might think, oh no, everybody should defend, and there's a certain level, but that's not what his role was. Watching Aubameyang finish and train was incredible watching him move. I had 6 months with Alexis Sanchez, and he was quite challenging to work with. But when games were on, and he would never, if we were playing, we could be playing Wrexham in the first round of the Carling Cup. He was like, no, I'm playing. I play. You don't know. I play. You know, that sort of stuff. And like, okay, no worries. Yeah. And so I love the fact that his
tenacity,
determination to play every game was incredible. And his skill level was off the charts.
Yeah.
So probably those three stood out of the young kids. Bukayo Saka was just incredible. And we're starting to see that now. He was, you know, 15, 16.
Yeah.
You watch him in the academy and you just thought, get this kid up and train. And Unai Emery, to his credit, recognised that early and said, no, no, no.
Yeah.
He needs to train with us. He's too good for that.
Yeah. Looking back on it, you obviously arrived there at a very tumultuous time for the club. Arsene Wenger left midway through the next season. Well, sorry, midway through the next year at the end of the 17-18 season. And then, look, there's been a turnover of coaches and caretaker managers ever since. The way it all came to an end for you, was it a sad time for you to get sort of swept out with, you know, along with, you know, the pretty much the entire back room of the club?
Yeah, it was tough. It was tough to take because I felt we were building something quite nicely. I was recruited along with Sven Mislintat, who was brought in to recruit the best under 25 players in the world. Husfarmi, who was a sort of the contract negotiator to do the deals, and myself and I guess my team to transform those under 25-year-old kids into world-class players. And we'd started down some of that path. Then when Ivan left, he said to me, when Arsene left, I thought, okay, this is not perfect, but, you know, let's give this a chance. But then a month later, Ivan left and Sven left. And so everybody that I came with had left, and Ivan said to me, look, you know, you're in a bit of trouble here. And I said, I know that. I know how it works. Fortunately, I had good sort of contract protection. During the year with Unai, we got along pretty well and worked pretty well together. But it was clear it was a very different philosophy, and that's okay. But yeah, the way it ended, we had a pretty good year. And it certainly, up until about a month before it happened, it was a bit of a surprise. But I had a bit of time to get used to the fact that I was probably going to go out the door when we played that Europa League final against Chelsea. And that's how it ended. I would have liked to have stayed for maybe a year or two more and try and build on the good work. We saved the club over $300 million in injury payments.
Wow.
In the 10 years that we've been there. And so we built up a pretty good, you know, a pretty good team and a pretty good medical team, a pretty good fitness team to help the players out.
Yep.
But yeah, had some nice things said to me by players and by Arsene and those sorts of things, which helped. But that's unfortunately, that's professional sport, and even worse in the Premier League.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a ruthless business, isn't it? One that you've chosen to spend your life in. Darren, we need to take another break. We've got plenty more of your background to get through. I'm really curious to know, too, how you even developed an interest in elite-level sports science in the first place. So that's all ahead of us. This is Inspiring Stories. Darren Burgess is our special guest. Back with more soon.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. Inspiring stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. Our special guest in this episode is a high performance manager currently at Melbourne, but he's got an incredible back catalogue, Darren Burgess. Darren, thanks again for your time in chatting to us for this episode. I wanted to ask you, winding the clock way back, what's your particular background? Obviously, you've got a very strong interest in sport, but taking it down the avenue of sports science, where does that all trace back to?
Just a failed athlete myself, Tim.
Which is probably a common story in your line of work, yeah?
Yeah, it is. Well, most people get on these podcasts and say, yeah, I was really good. I got an injury and, you know, then I developed an interest in strength and conditioning or whatever, but I was just never good enough. But wanted to work in sport. I had a sort of promising early cricket career, but never quite made it. And yeah, just didn't really know what else to do. So yeah, this sports science was really in its infancy. And yeah, I wanted to go down that path, thinking that I would do an extra year and of a dip ed and be a PE teacher. That's what I thought I would do. I thought I'd take this route to it, and then just sort of fell in love with all things physiology and sports science, and was lucky enough to get admitted into an honors program, and it sort of stemmed from there. I got a part-time job with the Sydney Swans, and yeah, it sort of stemmed from there. Didn't get a full-time job till I was sort of 28, 29, because there just weren't any around. But yeah, thoroughly enjoyed the choice, and even though there's been some downs, there's been more ups, and yeah.
I read somewhere that when you graduated from uni in 1994, you were keen to go and work in England. You sent out something like 92 letters to professional football clubs over there. You got three
Three
responses
back.
that all said no. The other 89 didn't even bother getting back to you.
Yeah, they were letters. They weren't, obviously, there's no other way to communicate with them. And,
So you
so
physically
yeah.
just tapped out a letter, stuck it in the post,
Yep.
put a stamp on it,
Stuck it in the
hope for
post,
the
put
best.
an international stamp on it, spent the money that I was earning at Pizza Hut on stamps, and yeah, sent them across. And Wrexham, Leicester, and I've forgotten the other club.
Scunthorpe, I think, if I'm
Scunthorpe. Yeah, well done. Well done. Yeah, Scunthorpe. So yeah, at least they bothered replying, which is great. The others didn't. So
And finally, you did get the call up from Liverpool. I mean, as prestige clubs go, as much as I had to say it, even as an Arsenal fan, they don't get much bigger than Liverpool Football Club. I mean, what were you thinking when you finally got word from them that they wanted you to go and work for them? I know it was sometime after 1994, but when you got the call to go and work for Liverpool, what goes through your mind?
yeah, to be honest, because an Aussie doctor, Peter Bruckner, had sort of been over there and done a bit of an audit of the place, and mentioned, look, the fitness isn't quite what it should be. Would you be interested? And I said, yes. I was working with the Socceroos at the time, and we were trying to qualify for the World Cup. So it just was straight out of my mind. I just said, yep, if they want to speak to me, I'm happy, because I don't know what I'm doing after the World Cup. The moment it hit, though, Tim, was, I reckon I'd been at the club for 2 weeks, and one of the physios who was there said, I'm just going to pop down to Anfield to make sure the dressing room is stocked and with everything that we need. Do you want to come and have a look around? And I went, holy shit, I'm going to Anfield. And so I went down with him, and yeah, I just remember just walking in the dressing room like it was walking into your office. And I thought, I'm gonna. Well, and he said, where are you going? I said, I've got to go down the race. Like, we're gonna have a look. So yeah, I walked down the tunnel and tapped the sign and walked up and thought, yeah, this is a nice place to work. So then it really sort of hit me that okay, this is, I've been lucky enough to work with the Socceroos, and I still say, no matter what, I won't have a better job in life than working for your national team in a sport that you're passionate about. So being able to go with them on the journey to the World Cup was yeah, as good as I'll ever do, and as happy as I'll ever be. But yeah, that was pretty special. The first game at Anfield, we played Arsenal. It was a 1-1 draw. Joe Cole got sent off, and yeah, that was a pretty surreal moment. Yeah, that first game.
Can I ask on a personal level? It's something it's an unusual profession that you're in, and in terms of maintaining a work-life balance and having a harmonious domestic life, if you like, having to drag your family around essentially from place to place, and you being away a lot, is that tough to manage?
Yeah, it is, and I probably haven't always managed it as well as I should have. So yeah, it's certainly tough, but it's also really rewarding from an adventure point of view. Like, my kids were both born in Liverpool, and they so they're little Scousers and love the city. Even if I don't, if I didn't support Liverpool, they would. And they got to do 2 years in a really nice sort of school in London, and as a result of that, I got to take them to. I took my son to Tottenham versus Barcelona at the Nou Camp in Spain.
Yeah,
and,
wow.
You know, so they got to experience, they went to Spain a few times, to France, to Scotland. They got to experience a different way of doing things. My kids have been lucky enough to be in the dressing room of, you know, of Port Adelaide, of Arsenal. They've met Arsene Wenger and I've got pictures of my son running around Anfield with a ball. So, you know, there's some perks to it. There are weekend work and things like that, which is not usual. But on the whole, I wouldn't take it back and wouldn't swap their upbringing.
Yeah.
You know, for anything.
In terms of the knowledge that you picked up when you were, say, at uni, you know, a few years ago, compared to now, how much has it changed? How much has your job changed?
I guess as you work your way up, you know, my job now includes aspects of psychology and things like that, which were never part of it early on. It was just trying this amount one day, the next amount the next. So, excuse me, that was, it certainly changed. In terms of the philosophies around sports science, it actually hasn't changed that much.
Yeah.
You know, good nutrition, good recovery, and good progressive overload of training. It's all pretty similar to what, you know, we've been doing for many, you know, many experienced people before me and after me will do the same, have the same sort of methodology. So it hasn't changed that much. What we do have now is more tools to be able to evaluate how we're going. So there's a lot more technology and now I'm managing a nutritionist, a podiatrist, a yoga instructor, all these things, which I never had to do because I did all of those in the early days when we just didn't know any better.
What about on a level, you know, that you engage with the players with? I mean, you think of some of the philosophies and the approaches in years gone by. If you want to talk about AFL, you know, the Ron Barassi sort of method of just hairdryer in the face. You know, you don't see that much. You don't see Sir Alex Ferguson's sort of same hairdryer in the face berating players anymore. In terms of your role, the way that you talk to players, encourage them, guide them, have you had to sort of modify that yourself over the years as well?
Yeah, it's a great question, great point. Absolutely, I've had to. In the early days, I remember Stephen Gerrard telling me that, and I know that sounds like I'm name dropping, but I remember
it. No, you go for it.
I remember because it came from him, and I said, what makes a good fitness coach? And he said, previous fitness coach under Rafa Benitez, I liked as a guy, but he didn't get me fit. The one before that, the Benitez brought over first, hated him. I won't say the exact word he used, but I respected him more because we were an incredibly fit team.
Yeah.
And so that sort of changed my dynamic a bit. A lot of people in the job make mistakes, and I made the mistake early when I was working with the Swans of going out with the players and thinking, how good's this? I'm going out with Michael O'Loughlin or Adam Goods or Leo Barry. But nowadays, I find it easier to be separated from them. And that's obvious because I'm 47 and they're, you know, 20 and what have you. But I do find I have to work harder to find a common ground. And so I try and work on, okay, do they support NBA? Can I give them a few NBA stories? What are you guys watching on Netflix? You know, those sorts of things. And so they at least throw a bit of humor in, you know, to try and let them know that I'm not this ogre fitness coach, old gray haired, old school, try and relate to them on that sort of level.
Yeah.
Whereas over in the UK, if they don't respect you, it doesn't matter how funny you are or how much you know who LeBron James is, it doesn't matter. It's all about earning their respect.
Yeah. Darren, we need to take another break and then a little bit more after that. Your time, at Port Adelaide, we've barely touched on that, but you certainly spent a big chunk of your career there as well. Keen to know what's next for you as well. Not that I'm forecasting the end of your time at Melbourne Football Club, but where your next adventure might take you as well. This is Inspiring Stories. Darren Burgess is our special guest. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. Tim McMillan is my name. My special guest is high performance guru in Darren Burgess. Darren, before we talk about Port Adelaide, because I know you spent quite a while there, you've mentioned previously that the 2010 Socceroos World Cup was a career highlight for you. For fans of the Socceroos who followed them for a long time, a World Cup that we've been pretty keen to forget. Why is it so strong in your memory as being a highlight? I mean, it wasn't a great performance from the team, was it?
Yeah, I think most people don't recall what we had to do to qualify. So we were the first group to have to go through Asia, and that meant incredibly tough conditions, traveling to places we'd never been before in extreme temperatures. I remember we were playing the UAE, and I went to the ref and said, look, it's 47 degrees. We can't play in this, 47 degrees. And the ref got the thermometer, took it in the shade under the grandstand and said, see, 40, no problem. So all those sort of scenarios and bringing the superstars back from the European freezing cold into these extreme climates. So to qualify without losing a game was extraordinary for starters.
Yep.
Then when we went there, we had 4 points, which is the same as what Hiddink's group had the year before. Mm-hmm. It's just that we're in a tougher group. That 4 points wasn't enough. We went out on goal difference. We had Tim Cahill and Harry Kewell sent off in successive games. So I think people were probably a bit unforgiving, and that's mainly because Pim Verbeek was a bit abrasive and, you know, this sort of not this Dutchman. I guarantee if Hiddink had have stayed longer than 6 months, people would have thought the same as him.
Yeah.
So I think we, and Pim Verbeek, I must say, was one of the best, if not the best coach that I've worked with as a human, as a gentleman, as a friend. You know, it's an absolute tragedy what happened to him.
Yeah.
So I think for if people look back at it a little bit more objectively, they'll realise what an achievement it was from that group of players.
Yeah, okay. Port Adelaide, you were there for quite a stint in your career. You know, credited with really developing a strong running side there in the Ken Hinckley days. Is that a highlight for you as well? Really sort of turning around the nature of play, particularly in a team like that?
Yeah, it was. I absolutely loved the time there. Great club, great people. And I'd never met Ken, but we just had a synergy because he just said, no, I want players who can run. I don't really care if they make mistakes with the ball or maybe we lose a few players with injuries early on. I want them to know what hard work looks like. And that was music to my ears. And, you know, the Ken, Koshy and Keith Thomas turned the club around from putting tarps over the seats and 12,000 members to literally a year later, we're up around 45, 50,000 members. And we went to Adelaide Oval from Footy Park with some real momentum. So, we had a great group, a great team, fitness team around us, a medical team. And we were just able to really instill that belief in the players that they're working harder than everybody else. And they probably were. We took the guys to Dubai for camps, which we were ridiculed a bit because everyone was going to altitude at the time. But we wanted the guys to be able to play footy, not climb up mountains and, you know, put ski masks on and try and kick footy around. So we went, used cricket ovals, and we're always a sort of poor cousins of the Crows. So we took them to, had some contacts in Dubai to the Prince of Dubai's private facility, and the players were treated like absolute rock stars. And so it gave them a real belief that, hang on, we're elite athletes, we can play and we got some pretty good early success.
Yeah. Just finally, Darren, if you do ever get itchy feet again at the Melbourne Football Club there, not suggesting that you are, I don't want to start a rumour or anything, but as someone who's, you know, takes a fairly nerdy look at sport generally, is there a particular team or code or country that you would like to work with, you know, a particular Olympic sport or in a league somewhere? Is there anything else that you'd think, gee, I'd love to apply my skills there?
Do you know what? Not really, Tim. And when you work for teams like Liverpool and Arsenal, that sort of rules out. There's not too many teams that are sort of above that. The job at Arsenal was, at a director level. So I've always been fascinated by the NFL. So maybe one day I've done some consulting over there, and that's, I love watching it. I really have taken a great interest in it. But my kids are 9 and 10 at the moment, and, they're pretty important years for them coming up. And the D's are in a really great space, and the club has been incredible to work for, and the people are fantastic. So we're in a real sweet spot as a list at the moment, and hopefully I can keep riding the Demons roller coaster that most fans would know about better than me. Mm.
Well, the Demons fans will be absolutely delighted to hear you say that, Darren. So, well done. Congratulations on your part in their success in this season 2021. And we'll be watching them with interest. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. We appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
No worries, Tim. Absolute pleasure.
You've been listening to Inspiring Stories here on 882 6PR. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything. We look forward to you joining us again next time as we unearth another inspiring story.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.